A philosopher walks into a library and discovers something unsettling. Every book on the shelf contradicts itself at its foundation, not through sloppy thinking, but through the very structure of language itself. This isn't the setup to a joke. It's the radical insight that transformed Jacques Derrida from an obscure French academic into one of the most influential and controversial thinkers of the 20th century. His 1967 masterwork of grammatology reads like a philosophical detective story, tracking down a crime that's been hiding in plain sight for over 2,000 years, Western philosophy's systematic privileging of speech over writing. But here's the twist. The crime scene reveals that the detective, the criminal, and the victim are all the same entity, language itself. Western thought has long privileged speech over writing. Speech seems authentic, words flowing directly from thoughts, creating an illusion of pure self-presence. Writing appears as a mere copy, a technical tool that arrives late and risks distorting the original message. This hierarchy structures everything: how we educate children, phonics before writing, evaluate testimony, live witnesses over written statements, and conceive truth itself as something spoken and declared. Plato warned writing would weaken memory. Rousseau lamented it as civilization's corruption of natural speech. But Derrida noticed something peculiar. This hierarchy produces contradictions. Saussure condemns writing as exterior to language while defining linguistic signs in ways that apply perfectly to writing. Rousseau celebrates speech's immediacy while relying on writing to preserve his ideas. The very texts privileging speech depend entirely on writing to make their arguments, like using a ladder to climb onto a roof, then kicking it away while insisting you never needed it. Consider how tree means what it means, not through connection to actual trees, but through its difference from free, three, T, and every other word. Look up tree in a dictionary, and you find only more words, each pointing to others in an endless chain. Derrida calls this structure the trace, the mark of an absence that makes presence possible. Every time you use language, you navigate a network where each element gains meaning only through its relationship to what it isn't. Think of a constellation. Individual stars mean nothing in isolation, but their patterns create recognizable shapes. This demolishes the metaphysics of presence dominating Western philosophy. We've imagined meaning as something fully present in objects, consciousness, or divine truth. But if meaning depends on differences and traces, then presence is always divided. When you perceive something as present, that presence carries traces of everything it's not, of past experiences, of future anticipations. Pure presence becomes impossible, not as a practical limitation, but as a conceptual necessity. If meaning depends on differences and traces, then speech itself operates like writing. The voice doesn't give us immediate access to meaning. It substitutes acoustic signs for absent objects, installing representation at the heart of what we thought was pure presence. This explodes the traditional hierarchy. Writing isn't a corruption of speech. Both are manifestations of what Derrida calls arche writing, the general condition of all meaning-making through the play of differences, spacing between elements, and trace structures. DNA codes information through differences between base pairs. Computer programs operate through binary distinctions. Consciousness structures experience through differences and relations rather than pure presence. Consider your own thoughts. We imagine thinking as pure self-presence, but you can only access thoughts through language, through the system of differences Derrida identifies with writing. Your most private thoughts arrive as if from elsewhere, formulated in a language you didn't invent, structured by differences you didn't create. Rousseau's confessions reveal a peculiar pattern. He describes masturbation as a dangerous supplement to sexual relations, something that both fills a lack and threatens natural presence. His relationship with Thérèse supplements his love for Mama, who herself supplemented his absent mother. Writing supplements speech. Culture supplements nature. Each supplement promises completion while revealing that what came before was never complete. This logic exposes a profound truth. What we call natural or original is always already incomplete, always requiring supplementation. Nature needs culture. Speech needs writing. Presence needs absence, not as external additions, but as constitutive elements. Consider education. We think of it as supplementing natural development, but what would natural development mean without language and cultural transmission? Or technology? The smartphone in your pocket doesn't corrupt some pure human essence. It reveals that humans have always been technological beings, always supplemented, always reaching beyond themselves. Your identity depends on differences, on what you're not, on relationships with others, on memories never fully present. The supplement reveals that presence is always divided, completion always deferred, and what we call origin is itself a product of supplementarity. Rousseau imagines humanity's origin at southern waterholes, where families gathered and from the pure crystal of the fountains flowed the first fires of love. This festival represents a magical moment, society emerging but not yet corrupted, language beginning but not yet formalized, passion expressed but not yet codified. It's a beautiful myth and an impossible one. The prohibition of incest marks the transition from nature to culture, the moment when society, language, and law emerge simultaneously. The paradox: before the prohibition, incest couldn't be conceived as incest. After the prohibition, it exists only through recognition of the law that forbids it. We're always either short of or beyond this threshold, never grasping the origin itself. This reveals something crucial about all origin stories. What we call origin is inevitably already within the system we're explaining. Language emerges at an unstable boundary between animality and culture, but we can only describe this emergence using language itself. The supplement makes possible everything uniquely human: speech, society, passion. Yet this very property of man represents the fundamental impossibility of pure presence. We're always already fallen, always already supplemented, always already writing. Derrida's conclusion isn't nihilistic, it's liberating. Recognizing that pure presence is impossible doesn't destroy meaning, it transforms how we understand it. We navigate the endless play of differences rather than seeking fixed foundations, embracing the creativity emerging from supplementarity rather than mourning lost origins. This shift has profound implications. In literature, interpretation becomes endlessly creative. In politics, social orders reveal themselves as constructed through exclusions. In ethics, responsibility emerges from engagement with otherness rather than adherence to universal rules. Every conversation navigates traces and differences. Every decision depends on supplements and deferrals. The dream of full presence remains impossible yet necessary. We can't escape the desire for it, but we can find freedom in recognizing its impossibility. The dangerous supplement turns out to be essential, the condition of possibility for language, meaning, and identity. In a world obsessed with authenticity, Derrida offers different wisdom. Embrace the trace, acknowledge the supplement, recognize that meaning emerges from difference. Your words will never perfectly capture your thoughts. Your identity will never be fully coherent. Your relationships will never achieve complete presence. That's not a failure. It's the very condition that makes them possible.